When I was in elementary school, I was asked to pick a book from our school library and do a report on the person who the book was about. Now, I don't remember all of the specifics. This must have been third or fourth grade. But for some reason, I picked a book about Nellie Bly. I'm pretty sure they don't get into this part in an elementary school level biography, but she pioneered a new kind of investigative journalism by going undercover in an insane asylum. You're probably thinking, okay, Pamela, thanks for that weird little trip down memory lane, but why are you telling me this? Well, I was thinking about how I've always wanted to be an investigative journalist. Writing exposés and secret source meetings and mysterious phone calls, it all seemed cool. What I have learned and what this investigation in particular has shown me is it really is a lot of reading. I couldn't tell you how many mundane emails and reports and permits and lawsuits I have looked through. It is way less glamorous and way more tedious than they tell you it is in third grade. But every once in a while, when you're sitting in the middle of a pile of papers, you find something that doesn't add up. Maybe it's something that seems out of place. Just enough to make that little voice in the back of your mind go, I wonder. This episode is about what you find when you keep digging. You start looking for one thing and stumble on something else completely. How I found Biolab went from ramping up manufacturing in Georgia to suddenly shutting down almost everything. And it raises the question of whether Biolab's parent company, Kik Consumer Products, is setting the stage for a financial escape. So, let's keep going. I'm Pamela Kirkland, and this is Manufacturing Danger, the Biolab story. I'll be honest. This episode is packed with detail and reporting, but understanding the full financial picture of Biolab and Kik Consumer Products means taking our time. So if you need to pause or hit that back button, go for it. I'll be right here when you're ready. For some context, let's roll the tape back to season one. Biolab dates back to the 1950s, when the company was a mom-and-pop shop making cleaners for chicken coops. The company's Conyers plant opened in the 1970s, after they had moved into the pool business. They had changed hands a few times, as companies do. Chemtura Corporation was their parent company during the big 2004 fire. They owned a host of chemical companies across dozens of states. That's important to know, because Chemtura filed for bankruptcy protection in 2009. In 2010, they settled with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Department of Justice for less than $1 million in penalties under the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act as a result of the 2004 fire. That bankruptcy also limited the amount residents who had sued after the fire could collect. Jean Sadler, the Conyers resident who's been here for more than 50 years, she remembers.
Well, as I said, my children was living there, and they got enough to paint the house, which it still, and we painted before, and now the paint is peeling again.
The bankruptcy court approved just a $7 million settlement to cover more than 16,000 claims. According to the Wall Street Journal, people forced from their homes received as little as $230, others only $59. Chemtura's bankruptcy is actually the first court case I read when I started researching Biolab. So residents have seen how bankruptcy played out once. They have a lot, maybe everything, riding on how this plays out again. Jean Sadler and her kids lived through that, and you heard her say they didn't get very much money after a class action lawsuit was filed back then because they went bankrupt. This time, Jean is asking the company to be accountable.
I just want what is right. I'm not asking for millions. I'm not asking for half a million. I'm not asking for thousands. I'm just asking, do the right thing, people.
She wants to be repaid for the money she spent after the fire. She told me she bought humidifiers and air purifiers. She and her husband were forced out of their house. She said her car had issues that she attributes to the fire. So when attorneys started gathering clients to file class action lawsuits against BioLab, Jean gladly signed on. I've checked in with her every few months since the fire. Each time we spoke, she'd tell me she hasn't heard anything from her lawyer.
They have gone ghost on us. We have not heard anything from the lawyers that were supposed to have gotten so much money to represent us. No one has reached out to us at all.
And she's not the only one frustrated with being in the dark. Many residents have not heard much from their attorneys since signing on to the case. I've been following the lawsuits. The class action case is very slowly making its way through federal court. A federal judge consolidated nearly 24 class action lawsuits into one giant case to streamline the process. In the meantime, some people went straight to BioLab to get compensated for the impacts of the fire. The company set up a community assistance center and a hotline for about 3 months to process claims. Jean wasn't able to get anything from that. She missed the deadline, but she was also afraid that taking a check directly from the company would impact her case against them. BioLab had said early on that filing an out-of-pocket expense claim would not impact existing or future lawsuits, but many people just didn't believe that. BioLab did not say how many claims they processed, but said they helped 5,000 people in person, fielded 43,000 calls, and 18,000 emails while the claims process was open. But Jean says some of those claims were bogus, submitted by people who didn't even live as close to the plant as she does.
But the real people that still have to live there and still are there got nothing, not even a phone call, not even a letter in the mail to say, we're sorry for your inconvenience. Nothing.
After reading through a bunch of lawsuits, I wouldn't expect an apology. Companies like this rarely say we're sorry, not because they don't feel it, but because their lawyers won't let them. A year into this investigation into BioLab and its parent company, Kick Consumer Products, what's clear is they are very careful when it comes to language and how they move when they come under fire. If you own a pool, chances are you've used a BioLab product or one made by their parent company. BioLab makes products to clean pools and spas. Their parent company, Kick, also manufactures products that clean your home, like Spick and Span and Comet, at one point even Pine-Sol. A former employee told me that most of BioLab's pool products were made right here in Conyers. So when the company announced they were going to stop manufacturing here, it wasn't just a local story. It was a major shift for the entire pool chemical industry.
You know, in the pool industry, Kick is, one of the top names. Everybody knows them. They make good products, for household, for pools, household cleaning products. When they had automotive fluids, they were one of the top people in that. But
you remember Randy Garcia from the first episode this season. He worked at BioLab as the only on-site engineer and left a few months before the most recent fire. And he explained that whatever happens to the Conyers plant could have ripple effects across Kick's other companies.
It's a global company, right? They're not just in Conyers. They have plants all over the country, all over the world. So it's like, if you shut down this plant, could it be a domino effect to lead to shutting down other plants? Because, Conyers is not the only plant that they have issues in. It's just the messiest one.
And he says Conyers wasn't just another plant in the company portfolio.
It was, one of the larger revenue generators for the company.
5 months after the fire, BioLab didn't seem like they were just ready to walk away from the Conyers plant. Documents filed with Georgia's Environmental Protection Division show the company planned to install new vents and dust collectors, a possible sign the company may have been trying to rework the plant and find a way to keep production going in Georgia. 3 months later, they made the announcement they wouldn't manufacture. But what would that decision do to the pool industry? We talked to Rudy Stankiewicz about it last season.
Rudy Stankiewicz is CEO of Aquatic Facility Training and Consultants. He also hosts the Talking Pools podcast and has spent more than three decades in the pool business. Very important question for this purpose. What title would you like used?
I usually go with Grand Poobah, but
it's a good one.
Which is not a joke. I usually do. That's typically within the industry.
He tells me Biolab is a major player in the industry. According to market analysis by Business Research Insights, the global pool chemical market was valued at approximately $2.2 billion in 2024 and is projected to reach about $3.3 billion by 2033. He says the 2020 fire at Biolab's Lake Charles plant showed just how critical that company is.
I think 2020 was an eye-opener for everyone in how much of a role they actually did play. When that factory burned in Louisiana, following that was a tremendous chlorine shortage that swept across the nation. I don't know if you remember, I was on almost every major news network at the time because I said it was going to be Poolmageddon. And that was the big thing. And that's all you need to do to get on every news network is come up with one word that people think is fun. But Poolmageddon, and that's what it was.
Rudy says the fire at Biolab's Lake Charles factory revealed weaknesses in the supply chain.
That factory burning and shutting down put unnecessary stress on the other factories that would typically manufacture the products as well. And it just got to the point that it was too much.
The fire disrupted chlorine production nationwide. Prices surged. Pool stores couldn't keep tablets in stock.
After the Biolab fire in 2024, there was no major chlorine shortage. No Poolmageddon, as Rudy dubbed it. That felt like a big change in the industry. So I checked back with Rudy to find out what changed.
We're better prepared. We hope it doesn't happen. Another major catastrophe like happened when the fire in Louisiana occurred. But I think the cease in manufacturing at Conyers is just going to be a blip in the radar that the industry doesn't notice.
For the pool supply industry, the fire this time was manageable, partly because of the lessons learned after the fire at the Lake Charles Biolab and changes to the market.
Since 2019, import of chlorine has increased by 36%. So it opened doors. Other people were there and saw this, and it gave them opportunities. There's two new chlorine manufacturers in the country. I don't think they've started producing just yet, but they are built. The imports have increased, like I said, by 36%, so we have a lot more doors. People open their own pathways to get product in for their customers.
The fire at the Conyers plant didn't bring the industry to its knees like it had in 2020, because the industry built itself up to make Conyers a lot less important. And remember Randy the engineer saying,
it was, you know, one of the larger revenue generators for the company.
What does the pool industry resilience after the 2024 fire say about that? Or how or where Biolab makes its money now at all? The problem is, even figuring out where Biolab operates is complicated. After the first Biolab fire in 2004, the company rebuilt that warehouse. But then they sold it and leased it back. And that leasing pattern continued. The warehouse that burned down this time, Biolab didn't own that building either. I found one of those leased warehouses in New Jersey. I found another one in Texas. On paper, it's not listed as a Biolab facility at all. The official name is usually a logistics company that leases space to other businesses. So unless you know exactly what you're looking for, you'd never know Biolab was operating there. So Biolab's buildings are literally all over the map in ways that are borderline impossible to see. It's not just the buildings that make Biolab hard to track, it's the paperwork too. This all comes from a personal injury lawsuit out of Florida. A chemical plant in Palm Coast, Florida, called Sunbelt Chemicals, was accused of negligence after a worker lost his hand in an accident in 2023. Sunbelt Pool Products is one of the brands in the KIC portfolio. The case listed Sunbelt Chemicals, Centerbridge Partners, the big private equity firm that owns KIC, and KIC Consumer Products as the defendants in the case. But lawyers for Sunbelt jumped in to say the company had been dissolved years before the accident even happened. Biolab actually ran that plant. You'd probably never know that if you didn't read this lawsuit. It's messy. Between this complaint and the other outstanding lawsuits against Biolab, I started to wonder what the financials of KIC Consumer Products actually look like. For that, I had to call up someone who knows way more about balance sheets and Edgar filings than I do. Jill Shaw is a reporter for the Financial Times. She's covered corporate finance and helped me make sense of some of this. Last season, we talked about how KIC, and thus Biolab, is owned by Centerbridge Partners, a private equity firm that bought all of KIC Consumer Products for $1.6 billion a decade ago.
Centerbridge is like lots of other private equity-backed companies in that it's a leveraged buyout model.
So what does that mean? If you're a big private equity company like Centerbridge Partners, you buy some companies, you roll them all up into one, and then hopefully sell that bundle for a profit. That is what's called the private equity model. But private equity firms don't spend their own money to buy companies up. They borrow money, preferably cheap money, in the form of low-interest loans to do that. The people who loan the money are called investors. Jill says that keeping these investors happy isn't as easy as it used to be.
Essentially, interest rates in the U.S. were really, really cheap for a really long time before the pandemic. And so private equity really thrived under that model, and they were able to borrow all this money to buy all these businesses and then flip them and turn them around. Since interest rates went up, that model has really come under pressure because the debt's not that cheap anymore. And so trying to then sell it and potentially make less than what you promised investors that you were going to make has become really difficult.
So the model isn't working the way it has in the past, and private equity companies are dealing with more debt. Debt is not necessarily a bad thing in the business world, but distressed debt is a different story and bad news for those investors. Here's Jill again.
Distressed debt is when, a company's performance has declined so much that investors are not really expecting to get fully paid back on the money that they lent that company in the form of bonds or loans. Once you start to see that bonds and loans are trading at 80% of the value that they were originally issued at, that's when you start to say, ooh, this is looking kind of distressed.
KIC is a private company, which means they don't have to disclose their financial information to the public. But some of KIC's debt trades among investors, which lets analysts get a sense of how much confidence the market has in the company. Jill says once a company's loans or bonds start trading at a discount, investors are saying they've lost faith the company can repay their loans. And right now, she says, that's where KIC Consumer Products finds itself.
S&P lowered its rating of the company. So it used to be at CCC+, which is already not so good, if you can tell from all the C's. But they lowered it to CCC. They're essentially telling the sign to investors is like, hey, you may not get your money back.
S&P is one of the firms that provides financial reports to investors. Jill says that report also said KIC is tight on cash.
So what S&P flagged is that over the next few quarters, their liquidity is going to really tighten. That means that KIC needs more money. They're either going to try to get more loans or bonds, which are publicly traded among investors, or they're going to get even more private capital.
The other thing that kind of rating could signal is
this company could default on its debt
or filing for bankruptcy. leaving not just investors, but anyone the company may owe money to empty-handed. That's why the people of Conyers are afraid of Biolab bankruptcy again. Now, Jill Shaw says bankruptcy is not a given in this scenario. But if a company can't meet its obligations, then restructuring or even liquidation can follow. Also worth noting, Kik named a new CEO. Michael Slode had been the company's CEO since 2022. The company's chief financial officer, Stephen Jackson, will take the reins now. Before working at Kik, Jackson was CFO at Remington Arms Company, where he oversaw that company's bankruptcy in 2018.
I declare bankruptcy!
Hey, I just wanted you to know that you can't just say the word bankruptcy and expect anything to happen.
I didn't say it, I declared it.
Bankruptcy, the B word that residents like Gene Sadler fear the most. But it's not the only way the Conyers class action suit could leave residents wanting. More than 700 miles away, another group of residents and their fight to be made whole is playing out.
More than 100 people who live in and around East Palestine, Ohio, say they were tricked into joining a $600 million settlement after the derailment disaster in 2023.
We've talked about the chemical disaster after the 2023 Norfolk Southern train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. Many residents there signed on to a massive class action lawsuit that resulted in a $600 million settlement. Some of those same residents now are asking to withdraw from that settlement. They say the lawyers who represented them pushed them into signing away personal injury claims for small checks. They want out of the deal so they can pursue their own cases. At the time the settlement was announced in 2024, attorneys touted it as the largest derailment settlement they'd ever seen. But lawyers were also approved to receive 27% of that fund, almost $200 million of that $600 million settlement in legal fees. And here in Conyers, as the class action lawsuit against Biolab moves forward, there are growing worries that something similar could happen.
Contrary to the class action suits, what's the best way for us as residents of those that were right in direct, you know, impact of all this toxic stuff and everything to protect ourselves down the line?
Lawyers not associated with the class action lawsuit came to Conyers to tell residents about other legal options they might have. Mindy Bish is one of them. She's with the Keenan Law Firm.
The only people who get rich are lawyers, and the only people who get off are the defendants who caused the harm, and the people in between, they get squished. And that's what I believe.
I know some residents who decided to drop their case with the class action lawyers and file personal injury claims instead. Jean Sadler is not one of them. She's staying with the class action suit, but says she doesn't have much confidence in it.
Right. To be in a class action suit, that could be 5 or 10 years from now. We're in our 70s. Will we make it? Will we ever see, you know, anything? Probably by the time it would be $3.75. You know, because more and more people join in to say, oh, I was affected, this was done. But we were considered ground zero, and that's exactly what we got, zero, nothing.
And now, the biggest legal question in this case is sitting in Georgia's highest court. A federal judge asked the state Supreme Court to decide whether residents exposed to Biolab's toxic smoke can force the company to pay for long-term medical monitoring, even if they haven't shown physical symptoms yet. That ruling could determine whether thousands of people like Jean ever receive health coverage tied to the fire. Over the past few months, we've uncovered a lot. We learned Biolab stored more than twice the amount of reactive chemicals it reported to the county. We learned that employees had warned about corrosion, faulty sprinklers, and small fires long before the explosion. We learned federal agencies maybe didn't have a full understanding of the risks in the immediate hours after the fire and didn't deploy some of the tools that could have been useful. We learned this fire isn't an isolated event. And we learned Biolab won't restart manufacturing at the Conyers plant. And now we've also learned, as Rudy Stankiewicz told us, that the pool chemical industry has changed, geographically diversified. So much that while the fire that was huge for Conyers, to the company, it might not have been as big a problem as it could have been 5 years ago.
I don't think whatever production was going on in Conyers was essential to the industry. I think they probably rebuilt that warehouse in Louisiana so that it could absorb what was being manufactured in Conyers.
And if the Conyers facility is inessential to Biolab, does that mean that Biolab is inessential to Kick Consumer Products, the parent company? And what could that mean for the people in Conyers who want answers from Biolab? After all that digging, sometimes it's what's missing that says the most. For now, this is where the trail ends. Unsatisfying? A little bit. But don't worry, this season isn't over yet. Next time on Manufacturing Danger, the Biolab story, we go back to the testing that was supposed to bring peace of mind. Cheryl Garcia still has questions about what the testing shows, and an independent tester says the government's interest in his work went beyond curiosity.
Not conspiracy theory, conspiracy fact.
That's next episode. Manufacturing Danger, the Biolab story, is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting. This podcast was written by me, Pamela Kirkland. Grant Blankenship is our senior editor. GPB's podcast team includes Sandy Malcolm, Jeremy Powell, Jake Cook, and Mark Davenport. For more, visit gpb.org/podcasts.